Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We begin with the latest study of data on family incomes in advanced democracies that indicates the once envy of the world, the American middle class, is slipping below Canada, and that America's poor make considerably less than similar families in Canada, Sweden, Norway, Finland, and the Netherlands, the reverse of what was true 35 years ago. Branko Milanovic, formerly a lead economist in the World Bank Research Group and the author of The Haves and Have-Nots, A Brief Idiosyncratic History of Global Inequality, joins us to discuss the price American families are paying for income inequality that is featured in the new website, The Upshot, launched today by The New York Times. Then on this 44th Earth Day, we will speak with Paul Ehrlich, the president of the Center for Conservation Biology and a professor of population studies at Stanford University. We will discuss the state of the planet beset by a record level of CO2 in the atmosphere, the worst in over a million years, and one that is facing projections that the Earth's current population of over 7 billion will reach 9 billion by 2050, placing unsustainable pressure on food supplies already threatened by environmental degradation and global warming. Then finally, we'll explore the possibility of going green before it's too late with Eric Sanderson, a senior conservationist at the World Conservation Society and author of Terra Nova, The New World After Oil, Cars and Suburbs. We'll discuss his article at CNN, Want Green Cities, Lose the Cars, and look into the Earth Day theme of green cities and how biking, walking and light rail could do away with the need for cars. And joining us now is Branko Milanovic, formerly a lead economist in the World Bank Research Group and now a visiting professor at the Graduate Center of the City University of New York. He is the author of The Haves and Have-Nots, A Brief Idiosyncratic History of Global Inequality, and is a researcher on the new report from the Luxembourg Income Study Group that is the basis for an article, The American Middle Class is No Longer the World's Richest, featured in the new website, The Upshot, launched today by The New York Times. Welcome to Background Briefing, Branko Milanovic.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
And it seems, Branko Milanovic, that income inequality is very much in the zeitgeist now. I don't know the extent to which it will become an election issue in this year's midterm elections, but certainly when you consider that Thomas Piketty's new book is the number one bestseller at Amazon, do you get this sense that people are becoming more and more aware of this issue? And the New York Times website that was The Upshot that was launched today, of course, features your work and the works of others rather prominently.
Well, yes, indeed. Actually, as you know, inequality has been becoming it's been a zeitgeist for a while. I mean, every year we hear there is like really huge concern with inequality. Davos people talk about that, rich people talk about the politicians, you know, authors and so on. But it just keeps on going and becoming more, you know, more and more important issue. And obviously now with Thomas Piketty's book and this new results that was published today in the New York Times, it seems sort of become a bigger issue probably than ever. I mean, certainly nobody, I think, can remember in living memory that the inequality of income or wealth has become such a big issue.
Well, we've always had the American dream and the Horatio Alger myth, and there's always been the assumption that Americans are the best off in the world, and the American middle class has been in many ways the envy of the world up until now. So that seems to me the significance of this new data that comes from the Luxembourg Income Study Group. Give us a sense of where the American middle class used to be and where it is today.
You know, this is actually a very important finding. You know, people knew that, you know, at some vague level, and there were comparisons between the U.S. and other countries, and there were issues about mobility, intergenerational mobility in the U.S. But let me just put it very specifically, what is the huge contribution of this report? I think it's twofold. First, actually, it puts really the level of income, real income, because this is income adjusted for the differences in price levels that people in different countries face, puts the American middle class very clearly in a position it's positioned within other rich countries. Now, the middle class is still on the top. It's actually now being joined by Canadian, or maybe slightly overtaken by the Canadian, and, of course, by Luxembourg. But Luxembourg is a very special case. But what is the interesting part is that actually everybody below the middle class, which means everybody in the first decile, which is the bottom 10% of people, the second poorest 10%, and so on, has been overtaken by several rich countries. So really, people who are not being overtaken in terms of income are really only people at the top. And if you look at the evolution over the last 30 years, practically every 5 years, U.S. would lose sort of leadership in income terms of one income group, starting from the poorest and now reaching the middle. So this is actually very, I think, striking result.
But so this, the poor in the United States are even worse off than the middle class by comparison to other advanced democracies. A family at the 20th percentile of the income distribution in this country makes significantly less money than similar families in Canada, Sweden, Norway, Finland, and the Netherlands. And that's the reverse of what was true 35 years ago. But when you do these comparisons, I would think that in these social democracies like Canada, Sweden, Norway, Finland, Netherlands, Australia, etc., where they have enormous social services compared to what we have here in the United States, or all we have essentially is Social Security and Medicare, both of which are under political threat in this country. So do you factor in the fact that poor people in Sweden, for example, get 6 weeks vacation, full health care, pregnancy leave, child care, all kinds of social services?
No, actually, you know, the results are in that sense are even, how should I say, less favorable to the position of the U.S. middle class and American poor, because what we don't factor in a study like that, it's too long to explain for methodological reasons why we cannot do it, but we don't factor number of hours of work. For example, the point that you made about a 6 week vacation. We also do not factor in state provided education and health. So if these things were actually included, and that's very difficult, as I said, to include it on a comparative basis, actually the American slippage would be even greater. What is interesting here is that if you really even disregard these things, you still have several countries, you have listed them, like the Netherlands, Finland, Canada, which actually have overtaken the U.S. in the bottom half of the income distribution. And slightly creeping up, actually, if you project this, what has happened over the last 30 years, if you project it for another 10 or 15, then they might actually go into the higher income levels and be in the leadership there as well.
Again, I'm speaking with Branko Milanović, who's formerly a lead economist in the World Bank Research Group and now a visiting professor at the Graduate Center of the City University of New York. He's the author of The Haves and Have-Nots, A Brief and Idiosyncratic History of Global Inequality, and is a researcher on the new report from the Luxembourg Income Study Group that is the basis for an article, The American Middle Class is No Longer the World's Richest, featured in the new website, The Upshot, launched today by the New York Times. So in terms of the rich in this country who are clearly the beneficiaries of these trends that have taken place over the last 30 and 40 years, they pay lower taxes than the rich in just about everywhere else on the planet, don't they?
Well, they do, you know, and I think the significance of this report is also, or simply putting these findings in front of you, is also to realize one thing in conjunction with what we have seen actually in Thomas Piketty's work and the importance of the top 1%, which again pays relatively low taxes in the U.S. compared to the rest of the rich countries, is that actually the rationale or the narrative which is often used, which says, yes, of course, there are really some very rich people, but having these rich people is a condition, necessary condition, for the middle class to be really also doing well and to be rich. That really rationale is not there, because if it were the case, then U.S. middle class would not be overtaken by the North European or West European middle classes.
So the point being that in the United States, the wealth is not redistributed as much to the poor from the rich as it is in other countries.
Well, yes. I mean, the facts are that the rich in the United States are richer than the equivalent rich in the countries like Sweden or Finland or Germany or Italy or practically any other country. Now, partly you can say, well, of course, they're richer because the U.S. on average is richer. But that rationale is undermined by the results when you see that the median person in the U.S. is actually now not any longer richer than, say, a median person somewhere in Europe. So this is the problem. Actually, it highlights the issue that you have really the top 1%, which is extremely rich by historical standards, within the United States, because they are basically back in terms of the share of total income that they take back to the situation of 1928. So we have really had a sort of a return to the Gilded Age.
So in terms of other countries, that we have right next door, Canada, where the Canadian middle class are doing better than the United States, at least if they're on a par, but heading in a more positive direction. That seems to be the headline from this new article in The Upshot, launched today by the New York Times.
Well, yes, I actually talked to several people from Canada. Obviously, they are very, how should I say, almost incredulous and very keen to know how did it come that actually Canadian middle class is now richer or on a par with the American middle class. And, of course, they are not very happy with the evolution of the middle class in Canada. You know, we are not actually anywhere in the Western world or in the rich world. The middle class did not have a great time over the last 20 years. So there is, like, dissatisfaction everywhere. But comparatively, when you look at Canada, it has grown by 1%, 1% and a half per year over these 20 years. And in the U.S., it has really grown almost by 0.1%, so almost nothing. So in other words, you know, there is a difference. You know, it's not a significant difference, but it's important. It makes a difference after 10 or 15 or 20 years.
And it's worth noting, of course, that Canada has single-payer comprehensive health care for all of its citizens. And as we pointed out before, that's not factored in these numbers, but health care is one of the most punishing costs that the average American family, particularly the middle-class families, have to pay.
No, indeed, that's actually not included. And, of course, we look at disposable income, which means, as you said, actually, that's income after taxation. We do not look... And we, of course, adjust for the level of prices. But, you know, one thing which is also difficult to adjust is if you have catastrophic events or if you have, you know, health care emergencies that you have to pay, obviously that can actually totally throw you off balance. So, in other words, these are the elements which would make the position of the American middle class relatively worse to the other countries if we were to include them.
And what's the sense of the poor being so much worse off than the rest of these other advanced European countries? Is there a political constituency in this country anymore for the poor and the middle class? I mean, how do you factor in that in your study on a global basis? In other words, I think the fundamental difference with social democracies is compared to the United States, is that people in social democracies vote for politicians who provide social services in exchange for the taxes they pay. We seem to be an anomaly here in the United States where we vote for all kinds of other reasons like abortion and family values and other things. And we, as I pointed out earlier, we don't get very much in return for our tax dollars. So is there can you make a correlation between the political influence of the rich in our politics and the political influence of the middle class and the poor in other social democracies?
Let me make like two points. I mean, the first one, you asked me about the position of the poor, relative position. If you make like a very sort of simple-minded division of the, you know, people by income in the United States, you say, okay, they are poor, middle class, and the rich. It has been known for a while that actually U.S. middle class has been falling behind equivalent middle classes in other democracies. So that was kind of known. But I don't think it was such a big issue because politically, the facts are, and we have now actually empirical studies showing that really political preferences of the poor don't really matter very much in the political process because they don't vote, they don't have an influence, they don't actually have lobbying power, so they really didn't matter that much. However, with the fact now, which is known, that the middle class is also doing relatively poorly, again, compared, it's still a very rich, the richest in the world, the second richest in the world middle class, but it's still doing relatively poorly compared to the others, then I think political dynamics might change, because when you have an awareness among, I suppose, 40% of the population that things are really not going well, politically they could become quite quite powerful. So, you know, we know that the political voice of the middle class is relatively, you know, limited, but I think things might change. In a democracy, they might change.
But is there a correlation or an understanding that the fact that the rich have done so much better than everybody else in America over the last few decades and continue to do so, is there a correlation between their influence over our politics and their success?
Well, yes, there is actually. I can think of at least two studies, because I really don't want just to talk about something which is my impression or your impression or somebody else's impression, but there is a study by Larry Bartels, who done several years ago from Princeton, I believe, who actually looks at preferences or like issues that people care by income level, and then looks at the voting pattern of the senators or representatives who represent them. And of course, not surprisingly, he finds that actually for a given constituency, the concerns of the rich actually have six times greater influence on the voting behavior of the senators than the, you know, issues that are of concern to the poor. So that was an empirical study. Recently, there was another empirical study with a similar results, you know, saying the U.S. is in oligarchy in the sense that actually it is really the rich that influence political process, decision, rules, laws, and so on. So there are empirical results that we really can draw upon now to when we say things like the rich really have a disproportionate influence.
Well, but it does seem that the difference is because of this study, Branko Milanović, that you've been involved in with data from the Luxembourg group that indicates that by comparison, the middle class in America, which was the envy of the world up until now, is slipping and has slipped behind Canada, and that the poor are so much better, worse off than the poor are in other advanced democracies. The New York Times report today in their new website, The Upshot, says that governments in Canada and Western Europe take more aggressive steps to raise the take-home pay of low- and middle-class income households by redistributing income. So that, to me, is the smoking gun.
Well, it is true. You know, I think that there is now an overwhelming body of evidence. You know, we talked about the middle class mostly here. Then we have, of course, the studies which look at the position of the very rich, top 1%, top 5%, top 0.1%. Then we have all these empirical studies also that talk about the influence of the rich on the political process. And finally, we have one thing that you mentioned before, is this relationship between inequality of opportunity and inequality of income. You know, and there was this very strong belief, as you know, in the American dream, that if you have inequality today, maybe, it is not going to be the same people who are going to remain rich. In other words, it is a little bit like one sort of metaphor is like a hotel. You know, you have different people living, I mean, staying at different floors in a hotel, but it changes every night. So the argument was, well, it really doesn't matter if they're rich today because there will be somebody rich in the next generation. But what we find now empirically, that too is not really exactly true, that actually mobility across generations in terms of income in the U.S. is no better than in, you know, many European countries. So then you have really a conundrum. You ask yourself, like, if there is high inequality today, what does justify that high inequality? Because it really doesn't lead to inequality of opportunity. It makes opportunities more difficult for the poor.
Well, just in terms of the future, just in closing, Branko Milanović, there's also a recent study by the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development that finds that younger Americans are not keeping pace. Those between 16 and 24 rank near the bottom among rich countries, well behind their counterparts in Canada, Australia, Japan and Scandinavia, and close to those in Italy and Spain. So that's our future, right?
Well, you know, on many of these indicators, the one that I mentioned, for example, the, you know, inequality of opportunity, intergenerational transmission of wealth, U.S. ranks really like Mediterranean countries, like Southern European countries. And this was not normally a comparator for the United States because the U.S. obviously was for last century or maybe even a century and a half richer. Much richer. You had, of course, large immigration into the United States from Italy or, you know, even Spain. So clearly things have changed because compared to the Nordic countries, to the Scandinavian countries or Northern Europe, U.S. is slipping. And even that which show, we see that in the statistics that you mentioned as well.
Well, Branko Milanović, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Well, it was a pleasure to be there. Thank you very much.
Thank you again. I've been speaking with Branko Milanović, who's formerly a lead economist in the World Bank Research Group and now a visiting professor at the Graduate Center of the City University of New York. He's the author of The Haves and Have-Nots, A Brief and Idiosyncratic History of Global Inequality, and is a researcher on the new report from the Luxembourg Income Study Group that is the basis for an article, The American Middle Class is No Longer the World's Richest, featured in the new website, The Upshot, launched today by the New York Times. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking on this 44th Earth Day with the ecologist Paul Ehrlich.
There's room at the top, they are telling you still. But first you must learn how to smile when you kill. Want to be like the folks on the hill. A working class in the sacred land, it has seen many hands, it has wealth and gold, yet it is fragile and old, and now the greedy souls just don't care to know of the changes it will confront. So speak out loud of the things you are proud of. Love this coast, then keep it clean as it holds, cause the way that it shines may just dwindle with time, with the changes it will confront.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Paul Ehrlich, the president of the Center for Conservation Biology and a professor of population studies at Stanford University. He's a fellow of the American Association for the Advancement of Science, the American Academy of Arts and Sciences, and the American Philosophical Society, and a member of the National Academy of Sciences. Welcome to Background Briefing, Paul Ehrlich.
Nice to be here.
And on this Earth Day, Paul Ehrlich, we are faced with the prospect, well, first of all, we've already apparently just passed a milestone with the 400 parts per million in terms of CO2 in the atmosphere. I think the first time in a million years or something. We're also faced with the prospect of, by 2050, the world's population, which is now at 7 billion, will be at 9 billion. And with the rate of resource depletion and wildlife loss, what kind of a world will it be, do you think, by mid-century?
Well, the debate in the scientific community is pretty much over what are the chances of avoiding a collapse of civilization. My own guess has been about 10%. Very distinguished colleague Jim Brown, who's the world's greatest biogeographer and expert in energy, thinks it's only about 1%. We are on a business-as-usual course, being fueled by people who can make money in the short term, and we're headed for disaster. And I don't have a single colleague who doesn't believe it. The situation is deadly grim. We're having trouble feeding 7.2 billion people now, and we know we can't do that in perpetuity. And we're talking about in the next a very few years, certainly from my perspective, by 2050, having 9.5 billion people to feed. I don't think we'll make it, but it's possible.
So in terms of countries like Indonesia, where you have permanent fires, they've had to basically, people in Singapore and Malaysia have you know, had to resort to respirators because of the smoke coming from these constant fires. They burn the peat, apparently. And that those.
I mean, it's a huge health problem. Anne has, my wife, has asthma, and we, our second home is Australia. And in Sydney, a few months ago, she couldn't go outside because the bushfires were so bad. There was so much smoke. When we went to New Zealand, we could see the smoke still in New Zealand. Things are going down the drain, and you know, there's just a huge effort to ignore it. We're human beings like to deny the evidence in front of their eyes, and that's what we're busily doing.
Well, in terms of I brought up Indonesia because at the end of the day, they're destroying some of the last rainforests on Earth because of palm oil plantations. So is there any way that we can stop palm oil use? Is there any way we can stop, for example, the extinction of the rhinos? Because apparently in Vietnam, they think it cures all illnesses. Apparently the Tibetans kill tigers for some bizarre reason. Is there any way that we can get to the end user of these products that are destroying the planet?
Well, let's put it this way. I think there are ways we could, but I don't think we will, because the power is in the hands of people making money on this. The worst story in certain terms that I've heard this year is, you know, a lot of the destruction of the rhinos has been to get their horns, which are reputed in China to be an aphrodisiac. And a lot of us thought that the invention of Viagra would save the rhinos. But now we've been told that the dealers who are making a fortune on rhino horn are now grinding Viagra into the rhino horn so that it actually works. And that's pretty depressing. But, of course, what we need is a World War II-type mobilization of every nation to deal not just with climate, which is just one of several things. You already mentioned the loss of biodiversity, which is another way of clobbering our agriculture. And there's the problem of the toxification of the entire planet. That is, we have spread toxic chemicals that we now know can be deadly in tiny quantities from pole to pole, and we have no way of getting rid of them. We're starting to see resource wars. The Chinese are busily trying to grab land in Africa because they know they're not going to be able to feed their population very much longer, and they want to, the hell with the Africans, they want to grow food for China in Africa. You know, we're fighting a series of resource wars over oil, which is a commodity we should not be touching. In other words, invading Iraq to get its oil, to get control over its oil, would be equivalent, if we were starving, to invading Iraq to get control over its cyanide to eat. We can't afford to burn the fossil fuels. Every major university in the United States should be getting rid of their fossil fuel stock as fast as they can, not just because it's ethical, but because, of course, if the world ever wakes up, the stocks are all going to tank because they're based on how much resource the companies have in the ground. And if you have to leave the resource in the ground, guess what? I mean, it's really stupid financially, and it's incredibly unethical otherwise.
And again, I'm speaking with Paul Ehrlich, who's the president of the Center for Conservation Biology and a professor of population studies at Stanford University. He's a fellow of the American Association for the Advancement of Science, the American Academy of Arts and Sciences, the American Philosophical Society, and a member of the National Academy of Sciences. You mentioned being in Australia, where the bushfires have been going on relentlessly. The middle of Australia now has gotten so hot, apparently, that the kangaroos can't even survive there. Clearly, it is being impacted more than most countries in terms of the effects of global warming. Yet, for reasons which are entirely mystifying to me, the Australian people elected a global warming denying reactionary who has busily got to work and undone what advances have been made in terms of the environment. Is there any, having been there, is there any way that that Abbott can be stopped?
I would like to hope so, but I don't know. Interestingly, he's generally an idiot, but when he disbanded the government agency that was to deal with climate change, the public reaction was so severe that they raised millions of dollars in the public to keep the outfit in action, but as a private outfit. There are lots and lots of smart Australians, but the country's press is controlled by Rupert Murdoch. He thinks the more people you have in the world, the more people will buy his newspapers. We've called it the Murdoch summer. He's done more than any other human being to destroy our grandchildren's world He runs the Wall Street Journal, which lies perpetually on issues of climate. He runs false news, which can't even really mention the climate issues most of the time. So there are some, you know, there are some people who are going to have to be moved aside if we're going to have a chance of mobilizing to solve this problem. And it's going to take a long time, a huge amount of effort to do it. We could, I think, still do it, although some of my colleagues think it's too late. But we're not even starting.
Well, one of the motives behind Murdoch's global warming denial, or is just his pure cynicism, is that the second biggest shareholder in News Corporation, which the Murdoch family owns, or the majority shareholders in, the second biggest shareholding group in News Corp is the Kingdom Fund of Saudi Arabia. So, needless to say, the Saudis want to keep the oil flowing. It's pretty obvious, isn't it?
It would be a wonderful thing if the world would get together and subsidize the Saudis for keeping their oil in the ground. You know, if we have, if we switch to a solar economy, which we should, and we should be doing it very, very rapidly, we'll still be vulnerable to things like big volcanic eruptions. And there will be times when we may want to spend a few years still using fossil fuels if we have too much that clouds over and prevents our agriculture from working right and keeps solar power out of it. So there's all kinds of things the world could do, and it could work to, you know, soften the blow for people that otherwise are going to take a hit from getting off of fossil fuels. We didn't subsidize the horse collar manufacturers when we got rid of horses and moved to automobiles, but I think we should have advanced beyond that and be thinking as a globe, how do we solve these problems and how do we stop beating up on each other in order to have a unified approach to solving the global problems without which civilization's a goner?
So do you think, Paul Ehrlich, that maybe we should think in terms of not so much national patriotism anymore, but a global patriotism, given that the Earth is endangered and that we all collectively share in that danger, and therefore our allegiance should be to this endangered planet?
I think that we could learn a big lesson from the debates that went on when the U.S. Constitution was debated between the Federalists and the Anti-Federalists. At that time, the states faced the same kind of problem the nation states face today. They wanted to retain their special characteristics, but they also wanted to be ready as a group to get rid of the British if they came back, to have decent foreign policy, to have decent trade relations and so on. And it was heavily debated. The fact of overpopulation was a concern to Madison. If our country grew too much, what would happen to our representative democracy and so on? It's exactly the kind of debate states should be having today when it's crystal clear that the big problems humanity is facing are largely international and are largely environmental. And if we don't find ways to deal with them collectively, we're not going to survive. And again, that's what the our founding fathers debated, and they came up with a solution that's worked pretty well for a couple hundred years.
So, Paul Ehrlich, you mentioned China going into Africa and gobbling up enormous tracts of land to feed their population. The Chinese government actually just released a report last week indicating that one-fifth of China's land now is poisoned.
China is in very bad shape environmentally. They have one huge advantage over us, so that is environmentally, their government is ahead of ours. But they have real problems, as we do, with the states and provinces there. And so they're facing monumental problems, and they know it, and they're trying to do things. For instance, their water situation is terrible. They've been trying for centuries to move water from north from south to north, and so far they failed to do it well. They're having desertification. The air is unbreathable. They're realizing they can't keep burning coal. But the coal companies, of course, here are trying to export more and more coal to them. It's one hell of a mess, and most people are going along just as if the world is the same as it's always been and on a business-as-usual course. And unhappily, business-as-usual is taking us down the drain. The scientific community has spoken out on this repeatedly, but most recently with the IPCC report. Now, it was interesting to me, and I think really measured the state of the United States, when the second IPCC, that's the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, report came out. On the evening news, the retirement of a Dodger baseball pitcher got more coverage than the fact that the planet was in, that humanity was in grave danger. As one of my colleagues said, if you have a society where the highest values are mall crawling and sports, you're never going to have a decent education system. And that's why the education system is broken here, broken in Australia, and so on. We're in tough shape, and we're going to... The hopeful thing is that people will suddenly realize it, and all of a sudden the whole situation will change, as it did, for example, with the collapse of the Soviet Union. Human societies can change very fast when the time is ripe, and the problem for you and me is to try and help people to ripen the time.
So is there a, do you think, I feel like humanity is like the frog in the water that's slowly boiling.
Yes, right. Yeah.
And that perhaps what it might take, I mean, when for example, I mentioned in the opening that we have just passed this threshold of 400 parts per million in terms of CO2 in the atmosphere, which is the highest the planet experienced in over a million years. Now that, you know, in the rational, enlightened world, that is a wake-up call. But that's clearly not the world of the Kardashians and the mall-goers that you just referred to a minute ago. Will there be, you think, a series of calamities that will, in fact, wake us up, or will they happen too late? For example, if all of those wealthy people down in Florida find their estates are underwater, well, at that point, will it be too late to act?
Well, I'd be afraid that it would be. I was a little depressed by the fact that although Hurricane Sandy, which is exactly the kind of thing that's going to become more common, it didn't wake more people up and didn't have a longer impact on it. But the biggest problem you've already seen into, and that is, I'm afraid, when there's a catastrophe big enough for people to register on, it'll be much too late. For example, we've got to, you know, it's clear to everybody that we've got to greatly reduce our use of fossil fuels, 50% or more by 2050. A huge, huge, huge problem to deal with that we're not even starting on. And yet I think most members of our Congress think that if we decide to switch to solar power, that we can get half our energy from solar in a couple of years. You know, it's going to take 30 or 40 years at least to do that with all kinds of problems. Same thing if we decide to go to nuclear. It takes a long time to transition. And we're not even either debating these things or debating the ethics of destroying the world of our grandchildren and our great-grandchildren. And you hear almost no ethical debate. It's totally unethical, for instance, to oppose any program to reduce the size of the population by educating women, giving them full rights, and giving every person who's sexually active access to full modern contraception and backup abortion. Anybody who's against that is basically killing people and killing people in the future. Some now, because, of course, the opposition to abortion kills women now. Women have the abortions one way or another, but you make them unsafe. And in the future, people are not going to be able to eat. So highly unethical to keep burning fossil fuels, highly unethical for the Petroleum Institute to pay liars to get out and say the scientific community thinks it's uncertain whether climate change is going to affect us. So the ethics issues are just not discussed.
Well, now, does that mean, Paul Ehrlich, that we should not think of having children as a right but as a privilege, and that there's also an enormous number of unwanted, unloved children in the world?
Exactly, and it'd be very inexpensive to help women have the children they want to begin with and to educate them. So the critical thing is you should want to have the number of children that, A, you can support, and that, B, will not make the world worse for them and for their grandchildren and so on. In other words, there's no right to have as many children as you want. That's a made-up right. The number of children you have should be judged both to your capability of raising them and to what the size of the population the society has to be for your children to be able to have a decent life and to be able to have children of their own. When you look at things like the Octomom, and I can't remember the name of the other group, that's just insanity. Wholly unethical, totally insane. If you have three children, that means you're basically saying you don't care what happens to your grandchildren. I mean, obviously, if there's a second, if the second pregnancy is a multiple birth, that's a different issue.
Well, but in terms of the third world, the rationalization is that these very poor people have lots of kids because they some don't survive and they need them to work for in their subsistence state of agriculture, etc.
I was really speaking to the developed countries. There are some circumstances in poor countries where we ought to be helping them to with the problems of needing children to work and of the high death rates among children and so on. There are circumstances in poor countries where parents reasonably want to have more than two children for very good reasons. And I put that, it's just like consumption. There's a huge problem of overconsumption, but it's in the rich countries. In the poor countries, there and in some of the rich parts of the rich countries, there are problems of underconsumption. Remember, almost a billion people are starving. And something like 2 billion are micronutrient deficient to the point where it can affect their behavior and their lives. So the situation in the rich countries where the most serious population problem is the biggest is right here in the United States, because, of course, we not only have a gigantic population, we are super consumers. But still in the United States, there are people who need help. So it's again, a complex ethical issue that everybody ought to be talking about and everybody should be trying to do something about. And basically nothing's happening.
Well, just in closing, Paul Ehrlich, on this 44th Earth Day, is there any way that we can perhaps inspire people? I know we're depressing people with the facts, and that should not be. You know, the truth is supposed to make you free, but in this case,
anybody who wants to do something can go to mahb.stanford.edu, join the mob, get involved, put out your ideas for how we can save the world. Don't listen to elderly white men telling you what to do. Find out for yourself. And again, mahb.stanford.edu. Become a mobster.
I appreciate your time here today, Paul Ehrlich, on Earth Day.
My pleasure talking to you. Take care.
You too. Again, I've been speaking with Paul Ehrlich, who's the president of the Center for Conservation Biology and a professor of population studies at Stanford University. He's a fellow of the American Association for the Advancement of Science, the American Academy of Arts and Sciences, the American Philosophical Society, and a member of the National Academy of Sciences. And we're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back exploring the possibilities of going green before it's too late. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now on this Earth Day is Eric Sanderson, a senior conservation ecologist at the Wildlife Conservation Society and the author of Terra Nova, The New World After Oil, Cars, and Suburbs. He has an article at CNN, Want Green Cities? Lose the Cars. Welcome to Background Briefing, Eric Sanderson.
Hi, Ian. How are you?
Very well, thanks. Although I must say Paul Ehrlich has depressed me somewhat.
Yeah.
He gives us a 10% chance of getting it right before it's too late. What's your odds?
Well, I don't think we should be, you know, foreguessing what's going to happen in the future and casting aspersions on our possibility to make a better world out of it. You know, I think we should kind of bring that kind of can-do attitude that America had, say, during World War II, as Dr. Ehrlich said, and bring that to the problems that face us. And I think it's pretty clear what we need to do. What's hard is finding the political will to do it.
Well, presumably the political will come, I think, from below. It won't come from the top, will it? I mean, there's too much of a vested interest in business as usual, isn't there?
That's right. I think that's how democracy is supposed to work, right? So
right.
I think that's why you know, I wrote this little piece for CNN.com, and I can't believe the traffic and all the comments about it. It was meant to be provocative to suggest that if you want a green city, then you should not drive your car. And I didn't emphasize the environmental aspects of driving so much as the social aspects, you know, the expense that's associated with driving, the noise, the lack of parking, the traffic, and all the kind of social and economic costs that come with that. And then just suggested some ways that we can try and maybe move beyond, not everywhere, but in at least in our denser cities, to a life that's not so dependent on the car. And that's going to help us with oil and some of the things that Dr. Ehrlich was going to talk about, and it's going to help us with pollution, and it's going to help us make better cities that are more productive and better places to live.
Well, before we get into the choices or between cities versus suburbs or finding ways to around this suburban infrastructure that we have, just to touch on what you just talked about, which has generated a lot of traffic and it certainly has gotten my interest in your article at CNN, Want Green Cities, Lose the Cars. You say, want to give yourself a 17% raise? Stop driving. The average American spends more money on transportation than food each year. They spend twice as much money on transportation as on health care.
I mean, yeah, isn't that amazing? That's government statistics. That's last year's figures from the Bureau of Economic Analysis in Washington.
But then let's add to that then the damage we get from the absurdity of gridlock. In 1982, the average American spent 16 hours each year stalled in traffic. In 2011, traffic contributed to an average of 38 hours of misery per year, costing the nation an estimated $120 billion in lost time and wasted fuel. And another study shows that on an average, 30% of the traffic in cities is the result of people just cruising to find parking. I must say, I've found myself doing that and cursing under my breath.
Yeah, well, this is the American condition, right? This is what it means to live in America in 2014, particularly if you live in one of our cities and depend on your car to get to work.
Well, that's the whole point, though, isn't it? That statistics show that a car on a street can move about 4,400 people an hour, but the same street could move 52,000 people by bus, streetcar, or subway at the same time, saving enormous amounts of energies and cutting down on pollution.
Yeah, that's right. And also being quieter and more efficient. And if, you know, more people were spending some of the money they currently pour into their cars on public transportation, then it would also become more affordable. Of course, the thing that, you know, I couldn't write in 700 words is that it also depends on the form of the city. And we've, you know, put at least 100 years into building cities that depend on the car and depend on it to get around. So this is, you know, the kind of solutions I talk about in the piece are mostly about our denser cities to start with. But I think even for some of our suburbs, if we can increase density 2 or 3 times over where they are, your average suburb is about 1,000 to 4,000 people per square mile. And if those cities were about 10,000 people per square mile, then public transportation starts to pay for itself, and you start to get some of these other benefits that come with denser cities.
So you have to re-engineer then a way of life, don't you? You'd have to concentrate people in smaller areas.
Well, I mean, the amazing thing is you know, a lot of people, particularly young people, are selecting that lifestyle.
Right.
You know, the costs of having a car are so big, and if you add that on top of college debts and other debts young people have and the struggles they're having and finding a job in the economy, it starts to make sense for them to move back to cities. In the same way that, you know, urbanization is the number one land use trend of the last 100 years. You know, people are moving in huge percentages to cities. And even, you know, in developing countries, they're often living in very poor circumstances, but they do it because that's the best opportunity for themselves and for their kids to have a better life.
Again, I'm speaking with Eric Sanderson, a senior conservation ecologist at the Wildlife Conservation Society and the author of Terra Nova, The New World After Oil, Cars, and Suburbs. He has an article at CNN.com, Want Green Cities, Lose the Cars. So, but the idea, I guess, is that if more people concentrated in cities or suburbs shrunk, and then you would be able to have what greater lands for commons. In other words, the idea that we have to travel all these distances to go to work is counterintuitive.
That's right. That's right. You know, I think, you know, we have a history in the United States anyway of cheap oil for a very long time. For our grandparents' generation, and for many of us, for our parents' generation, but of course that circumstance doesn't really hold anymore. And because oil was so cheap through most of the 20th century, and controlled in a way so that it was so cheap, that encouraged people to drive their cars because that made the most sense. They were the fastest way to get around, and they were also very cheap. And so people, you know, bought cars in legions, and that helped the economy. And then they, you know, use those cars to drive to new houses on the edge of town, where they would take a farm field and develop it and build a suburban housing block. And then next year they would do the next one out and the next one out and the next one out. And then I think, for me, I think it's, you know, sometime in the late 70s, 80s, we basically ran out of the edge. We got to the edge of what I call in the book the practical commuting horizon, where it doesn't really make sense to build the next ring of houses out because you have to commute so far to get back into the city. And but our economy was so geared to this lifestyle of cheap oil and cheap cars and cheap land on the edge of the city that it kept going and going and going. And I think there's pretty strong evidence in my mind that that eventually led to things like the financial collapse in 2008 when, you know, housing prices collapsed. And of course, the places where the houses were foreclosed and people lost their houses were in those outer rings of the suburbs where people are making, you know, hour-long commutes to get to work, which is, of course, doubly sad because those are, you know, mostly young families who are just trying to do the best they can in a system, an overall economic system that is sort of just run out of any more potential. And so I think, you know, the way we think about the new economy of the 21st century is that we, you know, price our natural resources and price pollution accordingly, using various kind of forms of tax shifting schemes in such a way that it helps us make our cities better, in such a way that it helps make our transportation systems better, in such a way that helps us have that kind of renewable energy generation that everybody, even the oil companies, know we're going to eventually.
So, Eric Sanderson, your book, Terra Nova, The New World After Oil, Cars and Suburbs, does shows how the American relationship to nature shaped our past and predicates our future. So are we talking, and of course, we're thinking about the pioneers, the buffalo, all of that, and going back further to the Native Americans who lived in perfect harmony with their environment. Is this to say then that we have got to sort of rediscover nature and a way to exist with nature?
I think what we need to do is value nature and not just value it in a spiritual way and an ethical way, although those are very important, but also in a real way, in an economic way. And, you know, there's a set of tax schemes, Pigouvian taxes or externality taxes or severance taxes, double dividends are sometimes called too, which are ways of taxing natural resources in a way that those costs then get transmitted through the rest of the economy. And it's the kind of idea that actually has a huge amount of support in the technical community. Economists, both on the right and the left, think it's a good idea. Environmental scientists think it's a good idea. These sort of ecological economists think that, you know, having taxes that reflect the true value of natural resources, not just the extraction value, but the value that they are to nature, is the way to reform our economy and actually create not just green cities, but green countries and a green world. That will address the kinds of things that Dr. Ehrlich was talking to you about before.
Well, your book does talk about a self-reinforcing cycle of tax reform, retrofitted towns and cities, bicycles and streetcars, and investments in renewable energy. Just paint us a picture then of what a new city would be like with biking, walking, and light rail, doing away with the need for cars.
Yeah, well, the first thing is it would be a lot quieter. It would be a lot quieter. You'd probably live closer to where you worked, and your employer would help you do that. So you would be able to walk to work, a bike to work, or, you know, if the weather's bad or if you're, you know, not feeling well or you're elderly, there'd be a streetcar or a light rail, something like that, that's moving across, you know, over the surface of the ground to take you to work. The idea is that maybe we can move our stuff underground or move it at night so that the freight in and out of the city could use the same system, but at night when it's being less used. And you'd have all this additional space to do good things in the city with. You know, right now about 50 to 60% of our cities are devoted to the transportation space in our cities. So that's the most valuable real estate in the country. And if we could free up a fraction of that by being more efficient with it, then that would allow our economies to do better, allow our social lives to do better. And then it means that maybe we can even reclaim some of that land that's on the edge of the city, and turn that back to agriculture, turn that back to wild places so that you could, you know, have a great job, have all the cultural amenities of the city, and also be able to know the people that grow your food or even be the person who grows your food. I think, you know, as a technical matter, as a sort of matter of physics and biology, we can figure this out. The really hard thing is figuring out the politics. And like you say, I think that has to start with your listeners and with the people out there, the people I'm trying to reach out to through CNN and with my book.
And what about reinventing work? I mean, already you have people, doing telecommuting, if you will, working at home. I mean, most people work in computers in big offices at any rate, so it makes you wonder why they can't do the same work at home.
Yeah, no, that's right. I think telecommuting has a lot of potential, but yeah, I also think it's important for people to interact with each other. I work in a global conservation program. I work for the Wildlife Conservation Society, and I have colleagues all over the world, and we mostly communicate through the computer. But it still is a great joy when I get to see them and talk to them in person. So I think there's always going to be a need to be able to meet face-to-face, and there's a lot of value that comes from that. But, you know, I think it all depends on being able to live a little bit closer to where you work, so that these other forms of transportation become possible and even more desirable.
Sure. Well, you know, I don't know whether you saw that Larry David show, Curb Your Enthusiasm. You know, here in L.A., you know, you have a fast lane on the freeway, but you have to have more than one person.
Yeah.
And he hired a hooker, you know. Just, but yeah. The point is that if you drive on the freeways in L.A., you just look at all these cars that are just jammed in gridlock, and a handful of cars go whizzing by in the fast lane. There are so few people that, and the idea, if you have one other person with you, at least you're interacting with humanity. You're not just a slave to this damn automobile, you know?
Yeah, no, that's right. I think it's so much, what you grew up with. I grew up in California, too. I grew up in the Bay Area and grew up in the suburbs and thought that you just drove your car because that's what everybody did. And it wasn't actually until I moved to New York and realized that there was another way of living, and that it was actually a pretty good way of living, I was still American, and I still held the same values. I still like baseball and apple pie and all those things. And we still have, I should say, you know, my family, we still have a car because where we live, it's still sort of necessary. We're still sort of trapped in the same system. But at least I can glimpse the possibilities of a better public transportation system and a bicycle infrastructure and a life that isn't all about the commute, but is actually about living my life.
Well, Eric Sanderson, I thank you so much for joining us here on Earth Day.
Yeah, I appreciate your time. Thank you so much.
And again, I've been speaking with Eric Sanderson, as a senior conservation ecologist at the Wildlife Conservation Society and the author of Terra Nova, The New World After Oil, Cars, and Suburbs. He has an article at CNN.com, Want Green Cities, Lose the Cars. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.